Okay, well, I want to start by thanking the organizers for the invitation to this most interesting workshop and the opportunity to tell you about some of our work in the particle area. So over the last 7 years or so, in my group, we've been interested in developing molecular level theories that go beyond the mode coupling approach to treat activated hopping, and along the way this influences these other things. I want to acknowledge the many excellent collaborators I've had in both the colloidal area and the polymer area. For those of you who will be at the conference, I will speak on the polymers, particularly below TG, at the conference. But today I'm going to focus on, in some ways, the simpler case of just particles, but not only hard spheres, but also what happens when you soften the particles or if you change their shape. So let's first remind ourselves of the big picture. If we think about the alpha relaxation, and this really applies, I think, to all materials, we plot the log of a relaxation time versus inverse temperature. We typically need 14 or more orders of magnitude. And it's viewed that there's at least three regimes. At high enough temperature, there's some type of Arrhenius behavior. But somewhere around 10 to the minus 10 seconds, that could start failing. And then there's this narrow intermediate regime, it's called the crossover regime, sometimes fit with a mode coupling formula. And the view is in this regime, there's both so-called mode coupling effects and also landscape effects. And so this is from a classic paper, I believe, of Stillinger and DiBenedetti. And so as you lower the temperature, you start sampling some barriers, but those barriers are relatively low, and this is called landscape influenced. And Sri Sastry was a co-author on, I believe, this paper, or a related one. But then eventually, at something that's often called the empirical TC, this is the onset temperature, this is TC, this is determined empirically, then these formulas completely fail, and you go to a deeply supercooled regime for maybe the last 10 to 12 orders of magnitude, where definitely activation is dominated, and you can think of it as there being a high barrier that's temperature dependent. And then below TG, you fall out of equilibrium, and there's different physics, and I will not talk about that in this talk. Now, what I want to emphasize is in the colloidal world, as opposed to the objects being a nanometer, they're microns. And so that's three orders of magnitude, and when you cube that, you lose nine orders of magnitude. And so the dynamics is nine orders of magnitude slower. So instead of probing maybe 12 to 14 orders of magnitude, you probe 3 to 5 in the quiescent liquid. And this means that you're almost always in this crossover regime where there could be multiple effects going on. And I should also point out this same limitation applies to molecular dynamics simulations as we presently have them. So what is the simplest colloidal suspension that's been studied? It's also could be viewed as a hard sphere fluid. And it's athermal, not in the sense that there's not Brownian motion. There's temperature. It just doesn't affect the equilibrium properties. So the relevant quantity is the volume fraction, and it's the phase diagram is shown here. Below 49%, you have a fluid, and dynamics slows down a little bit, and I would say this is a solved problem. If you were in equilibrium and you had monodispersed spheres, whether you're in a fluid or whether you're in a suspension of solvent, you have crystallization. If you can avoid crystallization for whatever reason, then people typically report a glass transition around 58%. Now, that's important to realize that that's actually way below random close packing or the jamming state, which is around 64%. Now, the time scales for just one colloid in a dilute solution can be estimated with this formula. I'll call this the dilute Brownian time. And for the typical sizes of colloidal particles, this is big, you know, of the order of a few hundredths to tens of seconds. So what we mean by the glass transition is actually no different than in thermal materials. It's simply when the relaxation time exceeds the experimental time scale. In rheology and light scattering, that's usually set by about 10,000 seconds. So it's a kinetic phenomenon. Now, the beauty of colloids is you can see them in a microscope, and so if you do confocal microscopy experiments, or also you can see them on the computer, then as you increase the volume fraction and look at trajectories, there's a gradual but reasonably well-defined change from rather smooth motion, which could be cooperative and collective, but involves the accumulation of many small steps, to more solid-like transport. Now, this is a confocal image from Dave Waits and Eric Weeks' lab at 56%. in which they just image the trajectory of one colloid. It bounces around for a long period of time and then abruptly moves a distance of the order of its radius. So I refer to this as solid-like motion involving large amplitude events that are very rare or intermittent. So there's a huge amount of work done in the colloids, especially experimentally, but this is probably the most recent result, and it was important for what I want to tell you. This is work out of Montpellier with both experiments and simulations. So they used a fancy version of light scattering to measure the alpha relaxation time of a single particle on the length scale of the particle, or the cage. So this is a log base 10 plot versus volume fraction. And you can see that the data now has covered six orders of magnitude. That's more than had been done before. And so this is a log linear plot, so this is highly non-Arrhenius, highly curved. Now one message is the mode coupling theory, which has been applied to hard sphere colloids with significant success, has typically been applied over this number of decades, and that is the red curve. Now this is applied by fitting this critical power law by adjusting the location of a hypothetical critical point. And you see that the red line goes through the data pretty well over around three orders of magnitude. But the point, and the reason this was a PRL, is that these extra two orders of magnitude are way off this line. And so there's no divergence. And in fact, the form over this range can be fit to a sort of generalized free volume model where the singularity is not a critical power law, it's an essential singularity, and the exponent's not one, it's two. The other issue with regards to the mode coupling theory is that in the range where you can fit it, if you ask other questions, you get answers that don't agree with mode coupling theory, and I refer to them generically as large non-Gaussian effects. What I mean by that is if you measure on the computer or in the lab the non-Gaussian parameter, on the computer, decoupling of relaxation and diffusion is seen in this regime. The Van Hove function that describes particle displacements is grossly non-Gaussian. There's exponential tails, etc. So to me and others, I believe this is suggesting that in this putative crossover regime, there is other physics going on associated with large amplitude activated processes. So this is what motivates our work 8 years ago when I started thinking about this. And the goal is to develop a predictive microscopic theory, not only for colloids, but other materials. I'll focus on colloids here at the level of the forces. Now, mode coupling theory is a powerful approach, and I don't want to throw it away. We want to build on it. It has this ability to connect structure, forces, and slow dynamics. And as a material scientist and a chemist, I'm particularly interested in this because it allows one to address non-universal chemical or material aspects. But on the other hand, it doesn't address activated dynamics. And so the goal is to go beyond mode coupling theory to treat activated dynamics. And the simplest place to try to do that is at the single particle level. And so everything I'll tell you, you should think of as an attempt to develop a theory of the trajectories that you would observe of single particles in a computer simulation or a confocal microscopy experiment. Now, if you can include these activated dynamics, then it's well known that you will restore ergodicity at long times and the ideal mode coupling transition is destroyed. It becomes a crossover. And the minute you have these intermittent dynamics, I will argue that that's underlying these space-time dynamic heterogeneities. And the theory I'll tell you about can be generalized to nonlinear viscoelasticity. That's an advertisement. I probably won't have time. So over the last 7 years, we worked in these classes of systems, mainly particle suspensions and polymers. I'm going to focus on the particle suspensions. And the other thing is we don't have any singularities in the theory. I'll explain this more later. So this allows us to attempt, at least, to avoid fitting and adjusting parameters when we do confrontations of theory with experiment. In that sense, it's first principles. So the colloidal, here's a family of colloidal systems that we have studied over the last number of years. Hard spheres being the simplest, polymer particle gels. And then if you soften the hard sphere, and there's many interesting complex fluid materials. This is a many-armed star where many polymers are connected at the branch point. And by changing the number of polymers, you can tune the interparticle potential. Alternatively, you can take a polymer and collapse it into a little ball and chemically cross-link it. That's called a microgel. And again, by controlling the cross-link density, you can control the interparticle potential. So I'll tell you a little bit about that. And then a big step is, of course, to leave the world of spheres and look at non-spherical particles, which are important, of course, in molecular liquids, in which one has the new phenomenon of coupled translation rotation dynamics in the glassy regime. So what I'll tell you about today, hopefully, is these first three. I'll spend a lot of time on hard sphere simply because it's the first thing we looked at. The model's the simplest, and this is where I can most easily explain the basic concepts. And then at the end, I'll talk about the application of the ideas, the same ideas, to these soft sphere systems and these non-spherical systems. I'll no doubt not have time to talk about the nonlinear rheology, but I'd be happy to talk to anyone one-on-one about that. So this is my most technical slide, and of course I'm not going to go through the derivation. The approach that we've developed, we've given a name, the nonlinear Langevin equation theory. Now for the theorist, the mode coupling and similar approaches are built on approximations for time correlation functions, ensemble average objects. Our starting point is different. We seek a stochastic equation of motion for this tag particle in a sea of identical particles. And the key dynamical parameter we want to track in a stochastic dynamical variable sense is the displacement of this particle from its initial position. So that can be described in terms of a field, the density field of this tagged particle, and in more or less one line of exact statistical mechanics, in the Brownian situation where there's no inertia and in a colloidal suspension at short times particles are diffusing, you can write a time evolution equation for the evolution of the density field. It involves a short time diffusion process where you can think of this as due to, say, solvent drag in a colloidal suspension. But of course, the real complexity is this particle feels forces due to the surroundings. And so the density of this particle is coupled with the densities of the surroundings, which is in blue, and of course the coupling is from Newton through the gradient of the potential. And then the noise is quite complicated. So you could write an infinite number of equations. They would never end. That's the many-body problem. So one needs to introduce a simplifications to close this equation at the single particle level. That's the goal. So I'm not going to go through the math, I'll just give you the ideas and the technical approximations. And we've been motivated by thinking about a very viscous liquid, at least locally, more as a solid as opposed to a liquid. And this is a difference from standard mode coupling theory. On the other hand, we will adopt the idea that the key slow variable are density fluctuations. And moreover, we'll try to quantify the constraints of the surroundings on that particle through the average cage, hence the structure factor. And the real forces between the particles will be renormalized, as in mode coupling theory, by effective forces, which are again determined by the structure. This is the so-called direct correlation function. So these aspects have in common with mode coupling theory. But how do you get rid of the many-body problem, that is, the fact that the motion of the black particle is coupled to the motion of all the surroundings? Here we invoke an idea that is called, in the density functional community, the local equilibrium approximation. In the old liquid state community, it might have been called the Vineyard approximation, where we approximate the question of what is the dynamics of two tag particles that move a certain two distances in time t relative to how one tag particle moves. Local equilibrium is this approximation that this time-dependent ratio remains slave to the equilibrium pair correlation function. And that's the most central approximation. So when you take these ideas and work out the math, then the bottom line is a single stochastic equation of motion for this tagged particle. Now, of course, it could be any tagged particle. They're all equivalent on average. So you should think of this as a theory for the motion of any tagged particle. And the form of this is a nonlinear Langevin equation. Now, I've dropped inertia, which is certainly not important in colloidal suspensions. Now, there's three terms here, two of which are utterly trivial. this is a friction constant times a velocity. And so if I had a colloid in Duluth suspension and I try to move it, there's a frictional drag. It is balanced by a white noise random term, by the fluctuation dissipation theorem. All the effects of the surrounding particles enter through a term that I would call the caging force. Now, it's a force. It comes out of a dynamical theory. But in analogy with Newton, I'll write it as the gradient of something. And I'll call the something a dynamic free energy. So this is not an equilibrium free energy, but it's something like a free energy that controls trajectories. Notice that it's local in time, and so these surrounding particles produce a force on any moving particle, according to this. Now, how do you want to think about it physically is basically it's a spatially resolved time-local displacement field. That is, the force that this particle feels depends on where this particle is. Okay. So the statistical mechanical derivation leads to an explicit expression for the dynamic free energy. And for those of you who are familiar with density functional theory of crystallization, there are two terms. One term looks like an ideal entropy term, and it favors delocalization of this particle. The other term involves the effective forces as encoded in the structure, and this is favoring localization of the particle. So in the language of equilibrium density functional theory, there'd be an ideal term and there'd be an interaction term that I will call the caging term. This term, of course, depends on everything about what the real interactions are, what the temperature is, what the density is, etc. And so as you change those control parameters, the relative importance can change. Just like if you increase the concentration of hard spheres in equilibrium, they will form a crystal. Okay, so before I tell you what this theory predicts, I want to make contact back with mode coupling theory. And the mode coupling theory to make contact back with is a simplified version due originally to Kirkpatrick and Peter Wolness. So this is a nonlinear stochastic differential equation. And if you try to write out, you try to do ensemble averages, moments of all orders are coupled. And so you can recover what Peter Wolness called simplified or naive mode coupling transition if you average this equation and you assume the trajectories dynamically are Gaussian. In a Gaussian distribution, only the second moment matters. All the higher ones are related to it. And then in mode coupling theory, you ask, do the forces ever get strong enough so the particle becomes localized? So the order parameter is the long time limit of the mean squared displacement. And so I'll call that the localization length. So then it's a matter of math to just derive, in a few lines, a self-consistent equation for the localization length. And what you mean by the ideal glass transition is when do the dynamical constraints of the surroundings become strong enough that you get a finite value for this. And that represents the ideal mode coupling transition. The physics of this term is very simple. It's the long time limit of the force time correlation function exerted on the black particle by the surroundings. Now, because of the Gaussian approximation, it's not possible in mode coupling theory to move uphill. There's no thermally activated hopping. And so you'll have an ideal glass transition. It'll either be a volume fraction or a temperature, depending on whatever your control parameter is. But in reality, I think everyone agrees that what this really represents or signals is a crossover. That is, a crossover to a mechanism of transport that we call hopping that is not in this Gaussian-like theory. Okay, so now I'll transition to the results for hard spheres. And everything I'm going to tell you about comes from the nature of this dynamic free energy.
So how did you get the intensity in your case?
I took the nonlinear Langevin equation, I multiplied through by R, and I averaged it to get an equation for this. And then on this side of the equation, I assumed that R squared obeyed Gaussian statistics.
Okay,
Then the noise term disappears when I do the average, the ensemble average. The noise term drops out, just as it does in usual mode coupling theory. So this exposes a very simple way of thinking about mode coupling theory as a Gaussian approximation for trajectories, essentially. All right, so we can use integral equation theory for the structure factor and calculate this dynamic free energy. So the dynamic free energy has two terms. One is trivial, the ideal term. So what am I plotting? I'm plotting the free energy in units of the dynamic free energy in units of kT versus the order parameter, which is displacement of a particle. So the ideal term favors unbounded motion, delocalization. The interaction term favors localization, and as I increase the volume fraction, it gets stronger. So when I add these two things together, the net result is that below this volume fraction, the dynamical free energy is unbound. And so if I run Brownian trajectories on this, I will diffuse like a liquid. And above that volume fraction, it goes through a minimum, which I'll call the localization length. It's transient, and then a barrier. And so a trajectory would come down and get trapped, and then through a torturous noise-driven process, escape. And the mode coupling transition in this simple version of it is simply this change from this form to this form. And hence, it does correspond to a change to hopping. All right, so it may sound extremely simple, but there's a certain richness here, which I hope to convince you of, and its origin is because of the spatial resolution of this dynamic free energy. There's many relevant energy and length scales. So I've listed the three most important length scales if you're running trajectories on this potential. One is the transient localization length, and the other is the displacement at which the restoring force trying to bring you back is the largest. These length scales are relatively small, and they shift to smaller distances as the concentration goes up and the particles get more crowded. On the other hand, you need a rare fluctuation to diffuse over the barrier. The barrier actually moves out as you increase the volume fraction. And so the process of getting over the barrier becomes more difficult, or in simple language, the jump distance grows with volume fraction. Finally, there's a length scale I called the reaction point. At this point, the confining part of the dynamical free energy is negligible. And it's this point that we associate with the onset of irreversibility and diffusion. There are also four energy scales in this little toy landscape. There's the curvature at the minimum and the curvature of the barrier, which will play an important role in the diffusing over the barrier. And of course, most importantly, there's the height. And as the height gets large compared to kT, the hopping rate will become slower and slower. So what does that barrier look like for hard spheres is shown here in units of thermal energy versus volume fraction. So below this 44% or so, there is no barrier. The barrier grows in very slowly according to the theory, and so even up to freezing, and if you were in equilibrium, the barrier is only of the order of kT. If you have a kT barrier, you don't talk about dynamics as activated. But as you go higher, the barrier grows strongly. And based on this approximate theory, at the experimentally identified vitrification point, the barrier is around 7 or 8 kT. And that is not small. So in the beginning, what we did is to see whether this theory had any sense was to do some analytical work, right? So being a more or less a chemical physicist, I'm very familiar with Cramer's classic calculation of the mean first passage time over the barrier, which you can hope is analogous to an alpha time, and in fact, we have verified that's true. So you can analytically calculate, if you like, the escape time or the escape rate on average from this formula. And what enters is basically the barrier height, obviously exponentially. The curvatures at the well determine the attempt frequency. The curvature of the barrier determines the rate that you get over locally, and there's a friction constant. Now, we, of course, can solve the nonlinear Langevin equation numerically, and that's what I'm going to tell you the results on in the first part of the talk. We can also, in the early days, combine this type of analytical work with other analytical work using Green-Kubo formulas to calculate diffusion, shear modulus, etc. But I won't really talk about that. Yeah.
How different is your dynamical free energy from the density functional free energy?
Actually, very different. Jean-Louis, this is a force, right? So there's two powers of the direct correlation function, because I'm basically calculating a force-force correlation on this particle. In equilibrium density functional theory, there's basically one power of this. And so this is a dynamical theory, but it has these similarities, and the physics is in some sense similar, right? Maximize entropy or localize, but this relates to dynamics. Okay. Now, I want to tell you a few analytical things that we did before I start showing you numerical results to try to understand the physical content of this approach. And so all the physical content is in this caging force due to the other particles. And if you write down this caging force, this relates to Jean-Louis' question, you can think of it this way. This is a Fourier resolution of this caging force. There's two powers of k times c, which is a gradient of the direct correlation function. So that represents the effect of forces. And then you have to ask, are the forces correlated in space? And that's the density correlation function. Now, it turns out that for hard spheres, there's an analytical solution for these things based on Perkis-Jevic. And we can show that when the barriers are relatively high, that we can use the analytical formulas for these correlation functions and prove, as was done here, that the entire free energy is determined by one parameter. The parameter is the volume fraction times two powers of the pair correlation function at contact. And this parameter, in fact, scales with the barrier, and it actually determines the entire effective free energy. To me, this is extremely intuitive. If I have hard spheres, the only way they exert forces, they're really impulses, if they're at contact. And there's two powers of an effective force, so there's two powers of that. So this gives a real space interpretation of what's controlling this caging. Because it controls the entire free energy, we automatically have connections between the dynamics on all scales, from the localized state to the intermediate state to the barrier escape state. So just to give you two examples of what I mean by this that was derived analytically, is that the shear modulus is inversely related to the square of the localization length. I would say that that is really quite intuitive. The localization length's telling you something about the bottom of this well. What is surprising, maybe, is that the barrier, the quantity determining the long time dynamics, is inversely related to the localization length. So that immediately gives you an idea of why the theory predicts direct connections between the alpha relaxation, the intermediate time scale, and the early time scale.
Ken?
Yeah?
Before you leave the slide, your single, this approximation that you talk about, this contact, is very reminiscent of the Enscott approximation.
Yeah. Except that Enscott approximation, you have one power of this in the collision rate. But here there's two powers, and it's up in an exponential determining the barrier.
So it's like the Enscott approximation for the next higher order correlation.
Well, not really, because I mean it's a difference because there's two powers. But I agree that there's a similarity. The other interesting thing you can do analytically is you can make contact with the jamming physics. And this would be very impossible for us to do numerically, but because we have this analytical knowledge, we know everything there is to know about the form of this contact value as you approach jamming. In fact, it diverges as a simple pole, and it's squared. So the theory predicts that this barrier will always remain finite until you get the random close packing and then game over in hard spheres. So there's no divergences at any physical volume fractions until you get to jamming. Moreover, it predicts that the barrier will diverge as a double pole, the inverse of the distance of the volume fraction from random close packing, and I'll come back to that.
This is according to some equations.
Well, this is well known. Torquato and many, many, many other people have shown that as you approach jamming, the contact value diverges as a simple pole.
Yes, but
This is an exact result, actually. I mean, the theory is not exact, but the divergence as a simple pole is exact.
I mean, should I think of this as sort of effectively representing a cage just by two particles and summing over all the pair of opposite particles in some sense? And
that's not really two particles. They're all there, right? But because ultimately it goes back to a force-force correlation.
Yeah.
But that force could really be due to any particles in the cage. That's averaged over.
You might think of it as sort of the simplest approximation to a cage where you'd have to include all the neighbors.
So for example, there's not like some 3 and 4 and 5 body things. Of course, all the particles are around here. It's not in a gas.
But you don't have the correlations built into that.
That comes back to that in the very beginning, I renormalized the forces by two-point correlation functions.
Right.
And so that is non-perturbative. But it's a strong approximation in having two-point correlation functions.
And three dimensions, you might think, well, you need at least 4 to somehow.
Well, I think you're thinking about isostatic thing, and I'm not overselling this jamming thing.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's the theory of jamming.
I'm trying to understand what the assumption.
Yeah, I'm just trying to say that you can ask what happens as you go to random close packing, and this is the answer, and I'll tell you what's found experimentally to some extent. Okay, then the last preliminary is, we of course can just solve this on a computer, run 100,000 trajectories, doing the ensemble average means sampling the noise. And so this is a complicated process. If the barrier is high, the particle has to come down here, it more or less equilibrates, it tries to get out, it comes back, it goes over the barrier, it can come back, so there can be hops that are unsuccessful. And so the dynamics is noise driven, so there's large trajectory fluctuations. And so in this theory, there is heterogeneous dynamics, and it has nothing to do with static disorder. It's all about what I would call dynamic disorder. So to give you a feeling for this, this is a plot of two representative trajectories for when the barrier is 5. So what is plotted is the displacement of the particle in units of its diameter. So there's 1. And these 4 lines are the 4 characteristic distances in the dynamic free energy. So as you integrate away from time equals 0, the particle comes down, it gets trapped, it goes up to the localization length, and it fluctuates. Often when it gets this far and the restoring force is the biggest, it gets pushed back. And eventually there's a rare enough fluctuation that it moves up to the barrier. Now it may or may not go over it. If you get pushed back, you keep trying, it'll eventually escape. So there's recrossings or back hops, and there's large fluctuations in a sense. This is the same system, but just because of the noise, the escape times differ by an order of magnitude. So dynamic heterogeneity comes in through these noise-driven trajectory fluctuations, and they'll be the sole origin of everything I tell you about dynamic heterogeneity. So before I proceed, it's worth being a little self-critical. What could be the limitations and possible caveats? Well, I have a theory that's telling me in a spatially resolved way about a hop. And so the underlying assumption is that you can construct the full dynamics as a sequence of independent local events that represent these hops. It's like Enskog saying the sequence of dynamics is a bunch of independent binary collisions, but now the event is much more complicated. Is there evidence for this? I think so. In fact, I believe Jörg Rotler talked about this last week, that these hops appear to be largely independent, but there needs to be more work there. It's a single particle theory, so it can address single particle questions. So what about the standard density fluctuations, or what about stress relaxation? Well, I believe, especially if activation is important, that it's been shown in many simulations that these things are very closely correlated. That is, the time scale associated with single particle relaxation, density fluctuation relaxation on the cage scale, and even stress relaxation are very tightly coupled, and there's also experimental evidence for that. As a side comment for anyone who would like to know, we have unpublished work where we've generalized this theory to 2 particles. So we can literally talk about structural relaxation. How do 2 particles separate in a liquid? And our preliminary results suggest much of what we've learned with a single particle theory survives that. What about dynamic heterogeneity? Well, there is dynamic heterogeneity at the single particle level, but it's often talked about at the many particle level. Chandan Dasgupta talked about work with Shishash Sastry a few weeks ago, where you ask about mobility fluctuations in space and time. So how is the mobility of this particle correlated with the mobility of this particle, and how is a length scale defined dynamically through the so-called chi-4? Now, if the dynamics is hopping driven, then I certainly expect that there's got to be a connection between this higher order heterogeneity and single particle motion. That's my intuition. We have some preliminary evidence that it's explicit that makes this connection, and I'll show one example. Okay, so let's move on to the results. What's the simplest question you can ask? You can ask about the second moment. What is the mean square displacement of a particle in units of its diameter, plotted logarithmically, versus time, that's the Brownian time, for different volume fractions? So 43% is where the barrier is still zero. There's a tiny non-Fickian regime. Now, I'll remind you, there's no inertial regime. It's a model of colloids. And so your Brownian, your Fickian at short times, your Fickian at long times. As you increase the volume fraction, you have caging, you have a plateau, and it goes down. Now, one interesting thing to quantify this is, what is the point of maximum anomalous diffusion? So what is this lowest local slope, which you could call an objective measure of the cage size? What is that exponent? And so you can ask that question in this way. Fick's law would be the exponent would be 1. You can ask, what is the smallest value of that exponent? I've colored them with the squares. So what's plotted is that exponent as a function of volume fraction. The theory, now there's nothing adjustable here, we just take what the theory is predicting for us. The theory predicts there's sort of these two regimes, one when the barrier is almost negligible and one when the barriers are getting high. The green points are Van Magen's experimental data. So we're quite happy with this level of agreement. And notice that at 57%, that the slope is all the way down to 0.1. Of course, it's not zero. If you had a truly localized particle, it's zero. Now, if you have limited data, you, of course, be tempted to draw this line and extrapolate. And if you extrapolate, you get to zero, and zero is a solid. Things aren't moving. And so if we do that extrapolation, we would say there's an ideal glass transition at 58%. Of course, we know that's not true, because we know there's no ideal glass transition in this theory until random close packing. But these are the type of things that are done with simulation and experiment to try to extrapolate and define an ideal glass transition. And this extrapolation of the theory, in fact, produces a number that's sensible. Okay. So that's single particle diffusion. What about relaxation? So let's take a small break and inject a little experimental reality about numbers. So if you take the theory I've told you about and you plug in for hard spheres that the colloid is a 1 micron size, then these are the predicted alpha relaxation times. So, you know, this is, again, roughly consistent with experiment. The reason that you call something a glass at 57% is the relaxation time's 14 hours. And dynamic light scattering equipment basically can't go beyond that, so you don't see the decay. If you simply go to 61%, This thing goes up enormously quickly, and you're at 5 months. And of course, that you call a glass. So this is a plot for the experiment that I showed you before of Cipolletti, log of the alpha relaxation time versus volume fraction with the mode coupling fit, and then the deviation to the double essential singularity. These are the theoretical calculations determined by solving the stochastic nonlinear Langevin equation on the cage scale over the three orders of magnitude that are often talked about with mode coupling theory. The points are the theory. There is no barrier here, and there is a barrier here. The theory is smooth through that. Obviously, this is a log linear plot. It's highly curved. So what we did is we took the theory points and treated them as experimental data. And you could fit your favorite function to this. The red curve is the mode coupling fit. And the blue curve is a free volume fit. And over three orders of magnitude, it fits pretty good. And everybody agrees with this. But of course, beyond this point, in the experiment, it fails. And in the theory, it fails, although I'm not showing it here. Now, as I said before, analytically, because we could do analytical work, we could ask what happens at ultra-high volume fractions without it, the answer being clouded by approximate integral equation theory. So the theory predicts that the alpha time goes as e to a barrier, and the barrier's got a double pole, and so there's a double essential singularity. And this is what Cipolletti et al. Claim to be the best fit of their data in this regime. So I don't want to overemphasize that. There's certainly an error bar on this, and there's an error bar on that, but this is consistent with the experiments in the beyond critical power law regime. Okay, the last average quantity I thought I'll show you is one of the very first things we did to see whether this theory had had any use, which was to look at the self-diffusion constant. This is the log of the self-diffusion constant in units of Stokes-Einstein starting at zero dilute solution up. There's two data sets here. For short time diffusion, don't worry about long time diffusion. So this is true of liquids. You go up to, you know, around 50%, there's not a lot happening. Diffusion constant drops by maybe a factor of 30. And then as you go above 50%, it's like falling off a cliff, and it drops down to about 10 to the minus 5. The line is the theory, and it's not a fit, and there's no reason it should work this well. But we have not adjusted things to make the line go through here. In fact, there are no divergences here out until you get to random close packing, where, of course, you can't do the measurement experimentally. And this dashed line is just the most naive calculation of a diffusion constant based on a hop. There's a hopping distance and a hopping time, and then you would get this dashed curve. And so the form of this function is coming from a hopping process. So within this approximate theory, we're forced to conclude there's no divergences below random close packing, and the barriers are important above 50%. Now, if we take that seriously, then there should be many consequences of this on other quantities that are more sensitive to the non-Gaussian nature of the physics. And so that's what I'll turn to now. So one has to do with measure the incoherent dynamic structure factor not at the cage peak, but as a function of wave vector. So here's the structure factor of hard spheres, and we did calculations at these wave vectors, above the first diffraction peak, at it, and well below. We then plot this function versus time. At the highest wave vector, you see the fastest relaxation, no big surprise. But what happens at this volume fraction where the barrier is 5 kT is that as you go down in wave vector, if it was a diffusive process, this would massively shift over because you'd be following this law. There's no massive shifting over. In fact, there's almost a convergence of these curves so that the relaxation time is becoming independent of wave vector, which is the antithesis of a diffusive process. So why? Now this is, of course, the theoretical calculation. Well, you know it has to be coming from hopping, and is underlying this a growing length scale? So the answer is yes. So there's several ways to think about this. One is to define this quantity, the product of a relaxation time times a diffusion constant times a wave vector squared. For a Gaussian process, Diffickian diffusion, by construction, this is 1. And basically, mode coupling theory predicts this is very close to 1. So what we've done is use the theory to calculate these quantities and make a plot of R versus wave vector. Now, if the barrier is 0, we basically get 1, independent of wave vector. As we increase volume fraction and the barrier grows and the intermittent dynamics becomes more extreme, we get larger and larger and larger deviations. Now we went back to maybe Sid Yip's textbook, about for a book 40 years ago, when people talked about jump diffusion models. We also have our own theoretical way of thinking about this, and asked, can we describe the data points? There's curves here. Curves are a fit to this function. So this function can be motivated in several ways, but it says, think about the relaxation rate. Well, it has to be diffusive as Q goes to 0. But at high Q, where you're looking at intermittent events, you haven't seen many, many hops, which is what you need for diffusion, you have something different. And the simplest thing you can have is this Lorentzian correction, which introduces a length scale. And so if this is big, So you're looking at distances small compared to that length scale, then the diffusion constant is length scale dependent, and the time is wave vector independent. And in the opposite regime, you recover Fick's law. So that's the lines. And so this fits the numerical data, and it allows us to extract consistently the length scale. And so the physical meaning of this is extremely clear. It is a characteristic length scale. The particle must move before it crosses over to Fickian dynamics. So that is a growing length scale. That's shown in the inset. The length scale versus volume fraction, don't worry about the different points. It's a small technical issue. But the basic thing is it's changing by a factor of 3 over this range where the barrier is going from around 1.5 kT to 7 kT. So there is, even in this single particle theory, a growing length scale, and it's associated with the intermittent activated dynamics. Okay, so a big question in glasses, at least from the liquid size, is what is the connection of the growing time scale to the growing length scale? So all, I mean, this is really, this is figures not published, it's implicit in our prior work. We just plotted our numerical results. The natural log of the alpha relaxation time versus this non-Fickian dynamical length scale, and it's pretty darn straight over e to the 5. So this is telling us that the barrier is growing linearly with this length scale. And that's a very different scaling than these for the aficionados in the audience. I won't emphasize that. Interestingly, it's not too far removed from what she and Dasgupta found when they examined a four-point correlation function. So they measured this four-point correlation function and plotted the log of the relaxation time versus the growing length scale of this multi-particle dynamic correlation length, and they found an exponent that's even smaller than 1, so even farther from these things. So I think this is just some empirical evidence that, you know, the physics is in the more complicated multi-point thing is certainly not unrelated to what's going on at the single particle level. And it's also a demonstration that, in fact, there is a connection between growing time and length scale in this simple theory. All right, what's one of the other big heterogeneity phenomena is the coupling of self-diffusion and relaxation, or as it's often known, failure of Stokes-Einstein. So Stokes-Einstein at the single particle level, and Mark Ettinger has done experiments like this, is to ask, what is the relationship between diffusion and relaxation? Stokes-Einstein says they'd be a constant. They're inversely related. So we've calculated these two things, and we've just normalized by what the value is in the regime of no barrier. So when we plot this, by construction, it goes to 1. And if the barrier is below a kT, it's basically 1. And so if the dynamics is not activated, Stokes-Einstein works. And as soon as the dynamics becomes significantly activated, there's a large decoupling. So the diffusion constant is much higher than you would guess based on Stokes-Einstein. I believe numerology is important. Again, this is a calculation. There's nothing adjustable here. So just as a sensibility check, simulations of polydisperse hard spheres by Sanat Kumar and Tom Truscott separately find that this ratio is in this 10 to 20 range in this volume fraction range. And so the numbers are sensible. Now you can ask how this decoupling grows as a function of the alpha time. And that's a plot here. It's a log-log plot. The numerical results show a gentle rise. This is 1 order of magnitude. This is 3. And this can be fit to a logarithmic form. So it's popular in this area to define a length scale. I mean, it's easy to do. If I have d times tau, I take the square root, I get a length scale, and that's sometimes called the decoupling length. What we have found is that this decoupling length is precisely proportional to this non-Fickian crossover length that I discussed on the previous slide. And perhaps this is not surprising. Right, because the non-Fickian length is telling us about when the diffusion goes from length scale dependent to not length scale dependent. We can elaborate this a little bit by switching from Q space to real space. And again, there's been some very lovely simulation work done on this recently, particularly by Berthier and Kolb. to look at what's called mobility bifurcation and exponential tails. And so just go back to real space, look at the Van Hove function. Now this depends on time. So pick the alpha time just for exposition and plot the log of the Van Hove function versus the particle displacement. It is grossly non-Gaussian in general. That is, there is a Gaussian-like piece and then a, this is a log linear plot, and then an exponential tail. So you can interpret these exponential tails as these fast hoppers, where the fast hoppers are being driven by this, the noise fluctuations. And this exponential tail then immediately defines a length scale that I'll give a different name. And as you increase the volume fraction, this tail amplitude grows a lot, which means that this length scale grows. So we extract from this real space picture this length scale, and I'm not showing you the plot, this is all published. This length scale is proportional to the decoupling length scale, is proportional to the non-Fickian crossover length scale. So they're really just different ways of seeing the same thing. And by the same thing, I mean this idea that mobility is a function of length scale, even for this most elementary alpha process. Again, for the experts, we've discussed in the paper that, that perhaps our results can be interpreted in this dynamic facilitation idea, a la David Chandler and Wampi Garahan. Okay, so that concludes the hard sphere part. In the last half hour, I want to tell you about something that's newer, okay? Especially in the materials point of view, hard spheres actually are important, but there's a larger world out there. And so the first example is soft repulsive spheres, which are in fact models used in jamming studies and other studies. And they're a crude model for an important material class called microgels. And so these microgels, cross-linked polymer, by varying the cross-link density, you change the strength of the interparticle repulsion. And it can become very soft or very hard. So you can interpolate between very soft particles and hard spheres. And a very interesting Nature paper that came out recently from Dave Waitz's lab was on these particles, where he measured the alpha relaxation time, changed the cross-link density, and in a general sense went from a soft particle to an intermediate hard particle to a model hard sphere. He collected the alpha relaxation time data and made a so-called angel fragility plot. That is, the control variable is the volume fraction. These are different chemicals. And as is typical in the glass literature, you're going to define a glass transition as when the relaxation hits 100 seconds, and you define the volume fraction at that point as the glass transition volume fraction, and you normalize that. And so all these curves are forced to meet at this point. So the hard sphere in this representation is very fragile. And as you soften the particle, single particle, you get something that's intermediate, and then remarkably, you get something that's Arrhenius. Okay, so this is something that interests us in this large area, and I'll tell you something about it. So the model we're using is a small variant of what's used in the jamming community, although this is also used. It's a so-called finite range Hertzian contact model. So it's a pure repulsion. It's exactly zero outside the size of the particle. It's integrable if the particles can overlap, and it costs an energy, or dimensionless modulus, E star, and it grows with that exponent. That defines the Hertzian contact model. So we've used this model, and if you study the equilibrium structure, it's very sensitive to this stiffness variable, and there's unusual complexities as you increase volume fraction, because now jamming is not a literal event. Particles can overlap, and so you can go past 64%, and that's called soft jamming by some. So we've used this potential in exactly the same theory. Now, everything I will tell you the rest of today will be based on an analytical analysis, which is what we always do. We do Kramer's calculations, Green-Kubo calculations, to see if we're on the right track before we invest the time to do the trajectory studies.
In this kind of plot, I mean, Unschar plot is rationalized by the fact that a straight line is Arrhenius behavior, so the slope has a significant, it's an activation energy. Well, here your horizontal axis is just the volume fraction. So
So it's just by analogy, that, you know, it's not like what Arrhenius would say, as you said, because there's temperature. So if people try to ask themselves, what might be the analogy? And since inverse temperature is kind of like volume fraction, they just define if it's linear, it's Arrhenius. The words don't make any difference to me, right? What matters is there is a simple exponential law here, and then this is non-exponential. And so if I didn't tell you that this was volume fraction, right, if I just showed you the picture, you might think you're looking at inverse temperature, and it's not meant to be any deeper than that.
Right. But you also use the word strong and fragile.
And all I mean by that is, as I make a small increment in the control variable, I move up a lot faster than here. That's all you really mean by fragility.
The actual numbers, or volume fraction, what is the volume fraction of this soft one?
This is very complicated, because what in the real world, and when these particles start touching, they osmotically decompress and this, that, and the other. So that's lost, of course, in the normalization.
Yeah,
but the volume fractions can be well above one if you define the volume fraction based on the dilute solution size, because once they come into physical contact, they osmotically de-swell. Okay.
So in reality, it's all well above one.
Yeah. Well, most of them, I think all of them are above one. Yeah. And then the corresponding plot is in the Nature paper. Yeah. Okay. All right. So here's Cramer's theory calculations based on the nonlinear Langevin equation by Zhang Yang. What am I plotting? I'm plotting the mean alpha time, hopping time, over the short time scale that non-dimensionalizes it versus volume fraction. And E, okay, so the other thing I should remind you, although I guess it's obvious, this has a finite range, so formally if I take E to infinity, I recover the hard sphere potential. So for hard spheres, this is just our old calculations we've just chosen for display because we're talking to colloid scientists, six orders of magnitude, we have as many as you like, because it's a theory, it's an analytical calculation. There's the hard sphere result as a function of volume fraction, and Takeshi, here would be random closed packing for hard spheres. Now, as I soften the particle, perhaps unsurprisingly, well, they get shifted in this direction, but more strikingly, they become more slowly varying as you change this dimensionless modulus by this amount. In all cases, it's non-exponential growth, and it's this jargon that's non-traditional, would be called non-Arrhenius. And it's obvious that the fragility becomes larger as you harden the individual particle. There's one other very interesting thing here, which is real, we think. It even starts to bend over here. Well, but look at the volume fractions. So you're going beyond the classic jamming point because these particles can overlap. And so this bending over is an indication of what's the language soft jamming was used by Arjun Yod and Andrea Liu in a recent Nature paper. That just describes that the packing, actually, when you do simulation or integral equation theory, the packing of these things qualitatively changes beyond some point when they start overlapping. And fundamentally, the packing is the input to this theory. And so that's why these changes are there. And we suspect they're real. Okay. All right, so we could do this fragility game for fun and also to make contact with weights. We can replot the same calculations I just showed you, but now we normalize. And so we just decide that this level of time represents the glass transition. We normalize the volume fraction by the corresponding kinetic glass volume fraction. And then as we change the from a soft particle to intermediate to a hard particle, then we get this increasing fragility. Now we can't do a one-to-one comparison with the experiment. The microgels are actually very complicated chemical objects. They de-swell, there could be polymer chains on the surface, they may be carrying some charge, et cetera. But the trend is there. And so all I want to make is that qualitatively this idea, that this is the title of Dave Waits's paper, soft particles make strong glasses. That is, when the particles are soft, this linear behavior is what they mean by strong, and certainly the trend is correctly captured.
So can I just ask, you were using a Hertzian model, and the Hertzian forces are only valid when the contact radius is small compared to the sphere radius, and yet you are applying it at fairly high volume fractions, so are you really, is that, I mean, I know you're just using it as sort of an analytic form, but is it non-self-consistent at that point?
Well, you could ask the same thing of all the jamming people too, I guess. I mean, if I take a real microgel and I bring them up, as you know better than I, and you look in a confocal microscope, you start seeing facets form and everything else.
Right.
Now, of course, we're just using a central potential, and as you said, this Hertzian calculation might be good up to, I don't know, 10% deformation.
10%.
And so I think we're in that region where we have to start worrying about that. But if we're trying to compare to real microgels, there's a whole bunch of other stuff we have to worry about too. And the people that are using these potentials, including Ludovic Berthier and Tom Witten, are studying just soft repulsive particles. They're just using the same thing too and going to very high volume fractions and just saying it's a model, right? But if you really want to get serious about the connection to microgels, then you really have to really worry about this deformation and faceting issue. And we have not done that. Right, the last slide here, something does relate to Ludovic Berthier and Tom Witten. So let me remind you, there's two parameters in this problem. There's the stiffness of the particle, which plays the role of a dimensionless temperature, and there's the volume fraction. So here what I did is I fixed the dimensionless temperature, or the stiffness, and varied the volume fraction. So you can do the opposite. So now we fix the volume fraction. We go from 55 to 65 to 90, log, log. And now we change the stiffness. Now what you see is that the theory predicts that the world breaks into two regimes. At relatively low volume fractions, below random close packing for hard spheres, as you stiffen the particle, of course you're headed to the hard sphere limit in the potential. So you would expect that the time scale for relaxation will go up, but that it will eventually saturate. And some of this is numerical noise in the integral equations we're using as input. So this looks like it goes up and it just tends to saturate, because as this goes to infinity, you go to hard spheres. And if you're below random close packing, that's a well-defined state. On the other hand, if you're at the higher volume fractions, which have no analog in hard spheres, and you increase particle stiffness or lower dimensionless temperature, you get a spectacularly sharp increase, which it looks nothing like that and is unbounded on this scale. So there's two qualitative regimes predicted by this simple theory, and in fact this is anticipated in the simulation study of Berthier and Witten, who have a similar plot. And so one can massively enhance this thermal fragility as the volume fraction goes up. And the physics is nicely, I believe, described by some scaling arguments by Berthier and Witten in this paper. All right, so let me take the last 10 or 15 minutes to touch on another very recent thing. So what if you break spherical symmetry? Okay, the world is not all spheres. And certainly in the chemistry community, you only can go so far with that. At Illinois, we have a significant effort in this nascent field called molecular colloids. And so self-assembly and dynamics of non-spherical and or chemically heterogeneous particles. And so the simplest way to leave this world is to make a uniaxial particle, I think. And we've chosen particles that a chemist could relate to. They'd call that a diatomic molecule, homonuclear, and they'd call that a triatomic molecule. We can also do things like spherocylinders. So we would then characterize, these are not the same particles, clearly. They both can have an aspect ratio, a length to width, but the surface corrugation of this particle at fixed aspect ratio is certainly not the same as that particle. So we studied a lot of these issues for uniaxial particles. I just want to give you a short introduction. Now, how do the particles interact? Well, they interact according to the so-called interaction site model, where each particles interact pairwise through hardcore repulsions in this calculation. We've done other cases between the sites. Okay, so the theoretical challenge, or the interesting thing here, is how does glassy dynamics change when you have these non-spherical particles? And so, of course, you can still define center of mass translation, but now you have this qualitatively new question of how do the particles rotate, and is the rotation dynamically correlated with the translation? Now, to anticipate our understanding of this, since it's based on a theory that takes structure as input, here's a calculation based on Chandler and Anderson's so-called RISM integral equation theory of the structure. So what did we do? We took this triatomic molecule, colloid, made a dense suspension of it, we kept the volume fraction fixed, and we asked, how does the packing at the center of mass level change as we go from a sphere to triatomics of different lengths? So what's plotted is the radial distribution function between the center of mass. The black curve is the hard sphere. Okay, so it's got the usual bumps and wiggles. Okay. Now when you go from the hard sphere to 1.5, you're introducing a bond length that you can think of as incommensurate with the packing of hard spheres. And so it will introduce frustration or disordering. And so what that shows up as is that the correlation function drops dramatically. And so the structure is much weaker. If I go to 2, I'm back to sort of an integral measure, and it jumps to the green curve. And if I go to 3, well, now I'm starting to get things that are more elongated and could even line up to some extent, and I get the strongest packing. Now, every equilibrium property we calculate, a compressibility, a wide angle peak of a structure factor, the local G of R, no matter what, they're all non-monotonic functions of the aspect ratio due to packing frustration and then relieving. So it's not hard to guess then, based on, since the theory only knows about the forces through the structure, that the dynamics will be very interesting. In a sense, we expect it to be a non-monotonic function of the anisotropy of a single particle. Well, this is a long story, right? So Rizong and I worked on this for a while. You could maybe imagine that generalizing from spheres to non-spheres and dealing with the rotational degree of freedom introduces extra complexity. So I'll tell you nothing about the technical details. You can find them all here. But we adopt the usual simplified approach. That is, now there's two dynamic order parameters. We have to keep track of where the particle is, its center of mass, and how much it's rotated. So there's a cumulative angle of rotation variable, theta, and there's a center of mass variable. So if we were to do mode coupling theory, there would be two types of time correlations. The forces on the center of mass of the particle do the surroundings, and the torques. Now, in mode coupling theory, where you have an ideal non-ergodicity transition, at long times the particles can localize. And now you have to answer two questions. How is the center of mass moving? It's the Biwalor factor. And how much is it librating? So there's two order parameters, and there's two coupled self-consistency equations. Now, the mode coupling theory for us is the start of the problem. That just tells us where the crossover to activated dynamics is. We've heuristically generalized the sphere theory to the molecules to write down these two coupled nonlinear Langevin equations, evolution equations, because we have two dynamical variables. And now the dynamic free energy is replaced by a dynamic free energy surface, because we have two variables. Okay. So let's first ask what naive mode coupling theory predicts. And I want to emphasize that, in fact, this was first done in, I believe, some very beautiful work by Chang and Gutze with a full, much more complicated mode coupling theory some time ago. We wanted to see whether we got something sensible relative to that with our simpler approach. So I view this as a dynamic crossover diagram. So it's a dynamic phase diagram. This is the volume fraction. This is the aspect ratio. And this is just for these diatomics, or dicolloids. By the way, these dicolloids are being made in Chip Zukoski's lab at Illinois. And there's another long story about how the experiment compares to the theory that's ongoing that I won't have time to tell you. Let's just look at this. It's really very interesting. There's three dynamical phases in ideal mode coupling theory, as first predicted by Gutze. There's a fluid ergodic phase. There's what's called a double glass phase, where both the translation and the rotation are arrested. And there's the analog of a plastic crystal, but it's a glass. And so the center of mass is localized, but the rotations are ergodic. Now, as you would guess, this can only happen when the anisotropy is small. These meet, so there's these three regions, and so if I have a low aspect ratio and I concentrate the system, I go from fluid to plastic glass to double glass, or I could go this way. If I went this way, I could even have these re-entrancy things. And that's because there's a dynamical triple point here where this plastic glass phase is pinched off. Now, for our material science interest, this says that if you could engineer this aspect ratio, if your goal was to maintain fluidity, the ultra-high volume fractions for processing or other reasons, then if you engineered the aspect ratio to be this value, you could optimize fluidity, or it would be the most difficult to vitrify state. And that's what's motivating my interaction with Chip Sukoski. However, this maximum of this lower boundary is also seen in granular matter, both ellipsoids of revolution, spherocylinders done by the Dutch group, and ellipsoids of revolution by Torquato, Stillinger, and Chaikin. So very interesting, the granular jamming point has a shape like this, and the peak is actually very close to 1.4, maybe by accident, maybe not. And the physical mechanism of this is clear in our theory, is a dynamical theory. These caging constraints, because of this packing frustration, the caging constraints are a non-monotonic function of the structure of the object. Okay, now, beyond these points, these curves, everything's frozen in mode coupling theory. For us, that's the start of what we're really interested in. That is, these are crossover lines, the activated dynamics. So I'll show you one example of a diatonic here in which we move well beyond the crossover line, so we expect significant barriers. The question is, what does that dynamic free energy surface look like? Okay, so I'm going to walk you through this. This is now this two-dimensional surface plot. So you have a dynamical free energy. It depends on two variables, the displacement of the particle from its center of mass, center of mass displacement of the particle in units of the site diameter, and the amount of rotation in degrees for this system. So here's the color code for how high the free energy is. So it's hard to see, but there is a localized state. So as the particles first try to translate and rotate, they get trapped. And the coordinates here tell you the Debye-Waller factor, basically, how much is this is going on and how much is this going on. Now the question is, how do you get out of that trap? For this system, there's more or less one mountain pass that can be crossed. Other systems, there can be more than one. Here there's one. And so there's a transition state. Of course, the system would try as all these trajectories, but there's a path of lowest barrier. So you have activated escape over the saddle point. And the saddle point has coordinates, right? So the transition state, and it tells you in a physical sense, as you would think about a chemical reaction, what is the transition state? So for this calculation, for this case, passing over the saddle point corresponds with a molecule rotating by 20 degrees and translating by a quarter of the site diameter. So we get this geometric information out, which is really just sort of thinking about what the eigenvector is. More generally, we find that this eigenvector, the nature of what this transition state is very weakly dependent on volume fraction, but strongly dependent on particle shape. And that you can imagine, as the particles become more elongated, I think Ansager liquid crystal physics, it becomes much easier for them to translate as opposed to rotate. So this way of just provides a way of thinking mechanistically of the alpha relaxation process or the cage escape process as one would in a chemical reaction.
And yeah. So the parameter that you're always writing down is just essentially this kind of like an aspect ratio, but you're always drawing dimers. Does it matter that you're drawing dimers?
Yeah, it does, because this calculation is four dimers. If I had a trimer or if I had a spherocylinder at the same aspect ratio and volume fraction, this would be different. I'm not saying it's qualitatively different, but it's quantitatively different. Every detail matters because the packing is sensitive to that. Okay. All right, so if I have this, then I can do Cramer's theory. Right? Cramer's theory has been generalized to multi-dimensions. We haven't done any Langevin simulation solution of the theory on this. So I'll just show you, this is probably my last slide, is to calculate the reaction rate of these. And in this case, we've done it up to n is equal to 3. So first, I'll just, I'm not going to explain this in detail, but this is this classic formula, a generalization of Cramer's theory to many dimensions, Jim Langer really pushed this forward when he was talking about nucleation. And so it involves knowing, obviously, about the barrier, but it also involves knowing about the phase space. It's sort of like an entropy factor of how big is this hole, you know, how many trajectories are important here, and how many trajectories are important here. So that all comes out in the wash in the Kramers calculation. And so what's plotted is a dimensionless Kramers time for going over the saddle point versus volume fraction. Now, sadly, somehow the hard sphere line disappeared off my computer, but so I had to paste in where one point for the hard sphere is. So for the hard sphere, the hopping time at this dimensionless time of 10 to the third, which has not been randomly chosen, for colloids, this would basically correspond to a relaxation time of around 10,000 seconds. So it represents a kinetic vitrification point. That occurs around 60%. Now let's break the symmetry. Go to an aspect ratio of 1.25, a massive shifting over, okay? Because we already saw the cage constraints were massively loosened. Go to 1.43, that's the dynamic triple point. So that's like that pinch point, so that's over even further. That's where you want to be if you want to maintain fluidity. Now, as you go further, then you get into trouble and things come back. And this is this last one here is for a particle of aspect ratio 3. Just as a point of reference here, we try to understand that what's really contributing to this, so we dissect the calculation. So what I call the one-dimensional path is to simply do a one-dimensional Kramers calculation along the saddle point and not take advantage of the fluctuations. Of course, then the relaxation time is longer by a modest factor. This one is what if you force this molecule to move without rotating? So again, we're taking things out of the theory so we can understand the theory. So now we say this molecule can only move by translating. And you get this massive, you know, 1.5, 2 orders of magnitude increase of the relaxation time. So this just tells you how important the fact is that you have to correlate center of mass displacement with rotation to escape the cage. Okay.
Is there something like a liquid crystal transition here? I mean, at any of these points, is there long-range angular correlation?
Well, we know. I'm not sure people know what the monadic phase diagram is for these bead things.
But is there an angle-angle correlation function in your theory that you could...
I'll be very clear about this. There's no liquid crystal order. These are isotropic states, period. We have no ability to actually predict from first principles liquid crystal transitions. And if we did, the theory would be much more complicated because then we'd have to have, you know, this direction in space and this direction in space. We'd have anisotropic transport, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. Okay, so what do you take out of this? Here's my take-home messages. Well, it's a log linear plot, so an analogy with Angel. They're a non-Arrhenius type behavior. They're curved, not enormously, but they're curved. There's this large non-monoticity, which depends on the structure of the molecule. These are actually the volume fractions, so you just read this off, right? That's a kinetic vitrification criterion. So the volume fraction goes up, and then it comes down. There are these degeneracy points, because the dynamic crossover phase diagram had this non-monotonic form. And if you examine the eigenvectors, of course we have all this information, I'm not showing it to you, but if you examine what the eigenvector is at the saddle point, then you find very strong suppression of the rotation, of course, as you go in this direction. And so if you want to think about exactly how the molecule sort of does escape, there's a big change as the molecules become more anisotropic. Now, I want to make another point, which is that, you know, the mode coupling theory, which is what gave us this idealized diagram, of course, there's no life up here. All the things are frozen in mode coupling theory. But this non-monoticity, which is the beginning of activated dynamics, is tightly correlated to the activated dynamics theory. And I think this reflects the fact there are these commonalities of how we're thinking about the connection between structure and dynamics, even though we're going over barriers. the information that's quantifying the dynamical constraints are the same. And I think this also explains why you can often use the mode coupling theory to fit things and get many, many, many useful trends, even if hopping is happening. Of course, you can't get dynamical fluctuation effects or non-Gaussian effects, but for these trends of what happens as you change structure or interactions, the mode coupling theory has proven to be quite useful. So I'll just conclude by showing this, because I think we're probably all getting hungry, and I don't want to go over, is that we can take this dynamic free energy idea, which is a baby landscape, right, and take it over to nonlinear rheology, and we do it sort of in a stress representation, motivated by this laundry list of things, and with the most simple being the old idea that when you apply a stress, the deformation reduces the barriers to flow. Now, we've implemented that in a dynamical variable sense, which is not the I-ring model, but it's in the I-ring spirit, sort of informed by, well, Craig Maloney mentioned Dan Lack's work in the potential energy landscape picture. As you apply stress, you can destroy this maximum, so you roll downhill. That's athermal. What we do, of course, is what stress does is it lowers barriers to the point that you can go over them through a thermal fluctuation. The problems we're interested in, that's what's controlling things. We're not at zero temperature. And then there's other issues here. So I think with that, I will conclude and thank you for your attention. I'd be happy to talk to anyone about that offline.
Just a comment about this volume fraction. As you said, that when these soft colors are touching or overlapping, the simple definition of the volume fraction by the original shape of the EM. So what's missing is the pressure. What happens is that this overlap occurs because of the pressure. So if you consider the pressure as a part of the potential, or effective potential, okay? Then what pressure is doing is shifting the minimum of the potential inside and inside. So, and this minimum can be guessed, at least, by the peak of the pedestal function. So if you redefine the size, not by the original size, by the position of PDF, and recalculate the fraction, I think it's useful. I think it'll make a connection between the soft colored and atomic glasses. And I predict that if you do that the packing fraction would remain or approaches the what we call ideal fraction, which is 74%, actually not even 63 or 64. 74%.
Okay.
That's the real...
Well, I mean, that's the dense-packed crystal, yeah. But I mean, I'm not worried about crystals here.
No. Yeah. But if you use soft potential, that is the packing fraction. In fact, the density of soft glass and close-packed FCC are almost the same. Almost both of them are about 74%.
Okay, but not for hard sphere colloidal glass.
But a soft one is not.
I think it's,
if you redefine that way, then it's a question of not the packing fraction, but I mean simply extending the attractive potential. Right? What you're doing is that by changing by applying pressure and then changing the apparent packing fraction. What is changing is not a packing fraction. Packing fraction, I think, is, as I said, very quickly approaching the 74. But the range of potential will change.
Yeah. Okay, I hadn't thought about that. I think that's a good suggestion, but I say if we do want to worry about the real world, there's another thing, that these things osmotically de-swell, then the number of cross-links per unit volume inside the particle goes up. And so, the modulus based on the most simplest rubber elasticity would say that you would also have like a self-induced hardening of the particle as it osmotically de-swells. And what's more important among these and other factors in the real world, I don't know.
can I ask a question? I mean, in glasses like Leonard Jones and selenium, one gets some law, characteristic law for the increase of non-Gaussianity and long-time decay. And we interpreted that as some signature of collectivity. Now you...
Of cooperative
motion. So you talk about single atom motion. So do you get the same time law or do you get a different?
Well, you mean time law?
No. I mean, if you start, you look at a system of T equals zero, non-Gaussianity increases.
Yeah.
Up to some time with more or less tau alpha.
Yeah.
And then a long time, of course, it decreases again.
Right.
And the increase is, I think, square root T, and the decay is
some other. We have all that. Okay, I didn't.
It's the same values. I mean, if we say that is due to cooperative motion, collective motion, and you say, oh, I get the same thing with single atom motion, then of course...
If you're using a non-Gaussian, you're using the non-Gaussian parameter for single particle motion to deduce something about collective motion.
Now, not to deduce it, but you're saying that if we made a model where you do make a model of collective motion, and that gives you this law. While if we put single atom motion in this model, we get a different one. Therefore, we say, okay.
This isn't single atom this is not single atom motion in a literal sense, right? This should be thought of as a dynamic mean field theory, essentially, in which the many particle effects are in there. When this, the field that this particle feels is due to the other particles, which is the same as it. And so there's this self-consistent link. We lose is the ability to...
You still have the picture of hopping out of a single atom hopping out of a cage.
Well, no, it's not like this one's hopping and all the ones are sitting around. I mean, we know that's not happening.
You get this question, simply, do you get the same time behavior or not?
I don't really know exactly what you mean by the same time behavior, but let me just state what we do get.
Yeah.
We get large non-Gaussian parameters.
Yes.
The shape looks like simulation, including yours. They can be as high as 10, the amplitude. However, the peak is absolutely not tied to the alpha relaxation time in general. As you go lower in temperature or higher in concentration, that is slaved largely to the maximum non-Gaussian behavior in the mean square displacement. And that to me is exceptionally physical, but let me just be specific about this. So we can look at this and ask, where is the peak of the non-Gaussian parameter? Now, it's true that when the barriers are not very high, first of all, the peak of the non-Gaussian parameter is more or less controlled by this point, which is the point of maximum non-Gaussian behavior in the mean square displacement. It actually occurs at a little bit longer time. Now, if the barrier is not too high, there's not too much separation between what I would call the late beta, early alpha regime and the alpha regime. But if you go to when the barriers are 5, 6, 7, 8, then the peak of the non-Gaussian parameter is tied to the physics of this regime, not that regime. So there's this statement that the non-Gaussian parameter is traditionally defined as a measure of heterogeneity on the alpha scale. I do not agree with that, and I don't not think it's correct.
Okay, I mean, it's fact. I have some factors 2, 3. I mean, I didn't want to be so accurate.
That's also not the point. I'm not saying it's off by a factor of 2 and 3. I'm saying that the factor it's off is a function of temperature and volume fraction. And then when you truly have a separation of time scales where you spend a long time in this localized state, that the peak of the non-Gaussian parameter is sort of around there, not when the particle is escaping the cage. But that's what our theory says. I agree that under many conditions, there's only these factors of 2 or 3 separating these time scales due to limitations of ND simulation. We have to take that into account and think about it carefully, I think. We can talk about it more. We're happy to show you our results for that. Yeah.
Perhaps it's a different way of asking the same question, but this is psi length that you define from the non-Fickian behavior, or from when you reach Fickian behavior. This is something which is, I believe, completely different from the psi correlation length that you get from a chi4 analysis that really involves collective motion.
That's true. It is different. As Sri and I discussed last week, though, I have other plots I could show you that attempt to ask how, what are the similarities between different measures of heterogeneity at the single particle level and at the four-point level. I mean, I'm not saying you don't need to study the four-point stuff. What I'm asking the question is whether the physics in the four-point thing is imprinted basically on the single particle thing. I mean, I'm not trying to turn it around and say single particle theory is exact, right? I mean, that's not what I'm saying.
The fact that you find psi proportional to the barrier height, is that some kind of coincidence from the model parameters?
This, well, I mean, it applies over all the range of numerical things we've done, but just for hard spheres. I mean, I do not have an analytical understanding of that, because the whole psi thing was deduced by running all these trajectories, solving things numerically. So I don't have a hand-waving physical explanation for why the barrier scales with that length. And in fact, it's pretty non-intuitive, right? I mean, Adams Gibbs might say it would go as the cube of the length, because I have a cooperatively rearranging region and I have to move those number of particles, and it's a compact cluster, so it goes as the cube. I mean, Sri's simulation results, I would say, are very non-intuitive in that sense, that the barrier goes as the length to the 0.7 power. So to me, this is suggesting it's, you know, not going to be easy to have a hand-waving explanation, but we should keep trying to try to figure it out. Mark, did you have any?
Yeah, so I mean, it also means it's very difficult, obviously, to really see the length divergence. But you can ask, for the hard spheres, you know analytically all the correlation functions, and you can find that there is a divergence at some point corresponding to random closure packing.
Right.
If you look at the other theories that you've tried, is there an analogous point where there's a true divergence of the barrier and the length, or not? Is there, do those other models end up having a true divergence of time scale?
Well, okay, this is one of the big questions in the glass area, and I haven't tried other theories, right? I just, I mean, I know, you know, the Adams-Gibbs model, the entropy catastrophe, if you believe the mean field calculation, says that the time diverges at finite temperatures. So the barrier goes to infinity at the Kautzmann temperature. The literal interpretation of the random first order phase transition theory of Peter Wolness is built on similar concepts. It would say there's a finite temperature divergence. Other models say that there is no divergence except at zero temperature. For hard spheres, there's some discussion that there's the analog of the Kautzmann idea. Do you run out of entropy below random close packing so that the divergence is below random close packing? Parisi and Zamboni have a mean field theory for that says yes.
But your theory would say it was at RCP.
Well, yes. My approximate theory says it's at RCP.
And I'm asking whether your approximate theory can make predictions about other models, or whether you just don't, maybe you just don't know the correlation functions well enough to be able to answer that question.
I mean, predictions of things that other models calculate.
Well, no, predictions as to whether for that particular interaction, say, that soft sphere potential, Hertzian potential, or dimers, can you identify some point where you would expect a true divergence, or whether you just don't know the correlation functions well enough?
But yeah, that's the thing. You know, the amount of analytical knowledge of these things is, the analytical knowledge is generally there for hard particles and only a limited number of hard particles. So we've asked ourselves this question for the soft particles, for gels, for all these other things. But there's no way for us to get a divergence unless there is a singularity in these structural correlation functions. And in hard spheres, there is a singularity at the contact value that corresponds to divergent pressure. And so my feeling is that there'll never be any singularities unless there's some analog of jamming. And since in soft particles, there really isn't, there's no infinite pressure state, right? So I don't think there's any, I mean, in the approximate theory, I don't think there's any singularities. But then, you know, if I keep pushing the volume fraction up, as you said, using the Hertzian contact model, I can study it as a model, though, and just ask what the question is. If I try to use it for a real material, then I have other problems.